From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Mary Tyler Moore. In The Dick Van Dyke Show, she helped break new ground, playing a wife with opinions of her own, and even more controversial, she wore pants. And in The Mary Tyler Moore Show, she played a single career woman. Moore says people often confused her with the role she played, but after her second marriage broke up and she was single for the first time, Moore looked to her character Mary Richards for inspiration. She's just written her autobiography. Mary Tyler Moore, coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Canadian Prime Minister Jean Chrétien says he's in a good mood about today's vote on Quebec's possible secession from Canada. He opposes the split. Meanwhile, Quebec separatist leader Lucien Bouchard says both sides have waged a good campaign. Bouchard says this shows Quebecers can take on big issues and continue to respect each other. There are a steady stream of voters headed for polling booths, and it's estimated that 90% of the electorate could turn out. Polls say the decision on whether Quebec will secede is too close to call. House Speaker Newt Gingrich says the Quebec vote should serve as a warning for Americans about the danger of bilingualism. Gingrich made his remarks at the Georgia Institute of Technology in Atlanta. Susanna Capiluto of Peach State Public Radio reports.
Gingrich said the United States should insist on English as a common language because that's what binds people together. Gingrich says he supports legislation currently in Congress that would make English the official language of the United States. He says he also believes that all American children should learn English and that foreign languages should be secondary in schools. The Georgia Republican said he does not worry about sending a negative message to the thousands of international visitors who will be in Atlanta next year for the Summer Olympics. In his words, people ought to expect to communicate in English when they come to America. For National Public Radio, I'm Susanna Capiluto in Atlanta.
Republican presidential candidate Pat Buchanan is launching a series of radio ads attacking the GOP Medicare overhaul proposed by Republicans in Congress. The ads began airing today in the key campaign states of New Hampshire and Iowa. From New Hampshire Public Radio, Eric Westervelt reports.
The conservative commentator, who has been hinting he may run for the White House as an independent, criticizes the Republican Medicare plans, saying Congress should cut foreign aid and congressional pensions, quote, before we cut Medicare. The Buchanan campaign will spend more than $25,000 to air the ads in New Hampshire and Iowa, home of the earliest presidential primary and caucus. Buchanan's charge that the GOP budget amounts to a cut in Medicare mirrors the Democrats' attack on the plan and has angered some fellow Republicans. GOP presidential rival Phil Graham's campaign challenged Buchanan to, quote, pull the misleading ads off the air. Buchanan's campaign says it stands by the ads and said Graham should cut his own multi-million-dollar pension before supporting charging seniors more for health care. For National Public Radio, this is Eric Westervelt in Concord.
President Clinton told attendees at the White House Conference on Travel and Tourism today that he sees good things in the looming battle over the budget. He says he's encouraged by the fact that the leaders of both major congressional parties want to finish the job. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up nearly 17 points at 4,758. This is NPR. South Korean President Kim Il-sung is trying to deflect growing public anger over a multi-million-dollar political slush fund amassed by his predecessor. President Kim is denying reports that he took some of the tainted $650 million out of the slush fund. Opposition parties say Kim is lying and might even have helped former President No Tae-woo raise the money. Kim, who was South Korea's first civilian president in 30 years, is under intense pressure to hold a full public investigation. The scandal is dominating the news. Fearing reprisals from the radical Islamic Jihad group, Israel has tightened security and limited the movement of more than 2 million Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. Islamic Jihad's leader was assassinated in Malta last week, and the group blames Israeli Secret Service. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
In a communique, Islamic Jihad promised attacks on Jews around the world to revenge the assassination of their leader, Fatih Shikaki. Israel has not admitted its Mossad agents were behind the attack, but's done little to discourage speculation that they were. Israel Radio today reported intelligence information about a possible suicide bombing, and officials urged the public to be especially alert. Israel also banned Palestinian students and workers under age 35 from Gaza from entering Israel. Cars with Gaza license plates were also not allowed in, and West Bank and East Jerusalem residents were not permitted to cross into Gaza. Israel did not impose a full closure, probably because of the Middle East Economic Summit currently going on in Jordan. For National Public Radio, I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
There are some new inductees planned for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They include David Bowie, Pink Floyd, and Gladys Knight and the Pips. The ceremony will be held January 17th in New York. New inductees also include Jefferson Airplane, Little Willie John, and the Shirelles. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Two of TV's greatest sitcoms starred my guest, Mary Tyler Moore, The Dick Van Dyke Show, and of course, The Mary Tyler Moore Show. Here's a typical Mary moment. Lou Grant wants to add some comedy to the newscast, so they've auditioned a guy who writes for Chuckles the Clown. His commentary on grocery shopping isn't very funny, but Mary is doing her best to give him the benefit of the doubt.
Well, you certainly were right again, Mr. Grant. Boy, I gotta give you that. I mean, this is just what our show can use. It's got warmth, charm, humor. Boy, you sure were right. Don't you think that you were right, Mr. Grant?
Mary, I don't think that belongs on our show.
But, Mr. Grant, this is just the kind of material that people can identify with. I mean, like what we just saw. Everybody goes to the supermarket.
I don't go to the supermarket.
Well, I mean, you got to admit it was funny. I mean, all right, it wasn't funny, but it was certainly funny, sort of...
Whimsical?
Right, whimsical.
I hate that.
Over the years, Mary Tyler Moore has played two extremes very convincingly. The sitcom Mary, the person everyone wants as their best friend, and the cold, steely character she portrayed in the film Ordinary People. She's got a pretty tough exterior in her new series, New York News. Now Mary Tyler Moore tells about the real Mary in her autobiography, After All. Her first big break in show business was playing the happy Hot Point elf for Hot Point appliance commercials broadcast during the Ozzie and Harriet show.
Happy Hot Point was the logo of Hot Point Appliances come to life, an elf, a little figure with a shock of blonde hair protruding from her little gray pixie cap that also had ears on it. But I was a Happy Hot Point, and I would, in these commercials, be superimposed on the ice cube trays, skating, popping out of the washing machine, speaking to Harriet Nelson and saying things like, "Hi, Harriet, aren't you glad you use Hot Point appliances?" Except my voice was higher then, so it sounded a lot more pixie-ish than it does now. What had happened was that at that time, and this was immediately after graduating from high school, I also got married immediately after graduating from high school. And about a month after that, I was pregnant. And the commercials were almost impossible to do anymore because I had my breasts bound down to begin with, even before I was pregnant, because pixies are supposedly of neuter gender. And to try to do that after I was even 1 month along, and certainly into two and three, was impossible. And so we had to stop. And I think they just went to straight commercials after that. And I went on to happily have my baby a few months after that.
Well, after you had your baby, you were the voice of the woman in the answering service for the TV detective Richard Diamond.
Right. That was played by David Janssen, and it was, I guess it had started on radio, and one of the successful elements of it was a character called Sam, short for Samantha, who was the answering service woman who took Richard Diamond's telephone messages. This was, of course, predating answering machines. And he would check in with me two or three times every episode and and I would answer in the sexiest imaginable voice, "Hi, Mr. T. I have some messages for you." And nobody ever saw Sam. You were allowed to imagine her to be your idea, your fantasy of the most gorgeous creature ever, certainly far from the reality of Mary Tyler Moore, who at the time was a fast 23 or 22 years old, freckle face, all-American girl next door type.
Now, let me jump ahead to the Dick Van Dyke Show. What were you told about the character of Laura?
Just that she was going to be a wife, a television wife, and that really had its classical parameters and dimensions, and they were established, and they hardly ever varied except as to whether or not the wife was the star of the show, in which case she was the funny one, or if she were the straight man for the male star, and she was then totally supportive. But all these wives were kind of obedient and, you know, a representative of the vows to love, honor, and obey. They hardly varied from that. And with Carl Reiner's character, the way she was written, Laura actually had opinions of her own. And while she was asserting herself, she also didn't make Dick Van Dyke look like a dummy. It was a matter of two people. I mean, society's expectations at that point still said, "Hey, wait a minute, lady, you only go so far here." But I think we broke new ground, and that was helped by my insistence on wearing pants, you know, jeans and capri pants at the time, because I said I've seen all the other actresses and they're always running the vacuum in these little flowered frocks with high heels on, and I don't do that, and I don't know any of my friends who do that, so why don't we try to make this real, and I'll dress on the show the way I do in real life.
But it wasn't that easy. The sponsors were afraid you'd look brazen.
Right. They pointed specifically to, they used a term, cupping under, and I can only assume that that meant my seat, that there was a little too much definition, and so they allowed me to continue to wear them in one episode, one scene per episode, and only after we checked to make sure that there was as little cupping under as possible. But
cupping under referring to the fit of your pants.
The fit of the pants,
on
yes.
Your behind.
On my behind, right. But within a few weeks, we were sneaking them into a few other scenes in every episode, and they were definitely cupping under, and everyone thought it was great. And the funny thing is, you know, women liked me. They were not envious of the fact that their husbands had a crush on me. It was okay with them. They were the first to, you know, when I would meet people, they'd say, "My husband loves you so much, and he thinks you're so sexy." And this was an odd thing because they were also able to identify with me as a friend, as a girlfriend. There was no resentment, no fear.
Yeah, well, I think that speaks so well for the character and your portrayal of her. Why capri pants? Why not longer pants?
There was a store in Los Angeles in Beverly Hills called Jack's, J-A-X, and a man named Jack Hansen owned it, and it's now no longer there. And he designed these trousers, and they came in all fabrics and all price ranges, from cotton to the finest moire silks. And I adored these pants. I loved them. I lusted after them. And I could just barely afford the cotton ones. But when I had a paycheck and it was on a regular basis from, you know, dancing in the chorus, I would make sure that I added another pair of pants to my wardrobe. And those were the design that I wore along with several hundred other young women who shopped in Beverly Hills then.
Mary Tyler Moore is my guest. She has a new autobiography called After All. Why don't we take a short break, and then we'll talk some more.
Okay.
This is Fresh Air. With Mary Tyler Moore. She's written an autobiography. It's called After All. Now, how did you come up with the voice to say, oh, Rob?
I don't know. I guess it began with the cry. The first time I cried was the episode in which Laura bleaches her hair blonde, looks in the mirror, and with her friend Millie's help decides she looks more like Harpo Marx than what her goal had been. And so she quickly tries to dye it back before Rob gets home from work. Now, this is a real stretch of the imagination. She decides to dye one half of her head back, not being able to get the other half done before Dick walks in the door. And so she greets him, half blonde, half brunette, and sobbing. And I had always been a big fan of Nanette Fabre, who worked with Carl Reiner and Sid Caesar on the show Shows. And I loved her humor. I loved the way she cried. And so when I was called upon to bring forth the tears in my scene, I'm not sure how much of it was out-and-out stolen from Miss Fabre and how much of it was just a matter of influence, but there was definitely a cracking in the voice and an inability to maintain a tone and a certain amount of verbal yodeling that took place. And from that came, oh, Rob!
did you do a lot of rehearsing with Dick Van Dyke? Or did you just have to do it minutes before the actual broadcast?
Oh, the whole show was done in what they call multiple camera technique. It's still done today. But back then, we were maybe the sixth or seventh show to use the technique. It began with Joan Davis, not Lucille Ball, as everyone thinks. Joan Davis did a show called I Married Joan.
What a girl, what a world, what a life.
Hey, yeah. Good for you. And then Lucy and several other shows followed. But in that show, it's a little like doing theater that's captured on film. You rehearse for 5 days. And then on the evening of the fifth day, the audience comes in, and the cameras, having blocked their moves and yours lined up with them, you film it from top to bottom in continuity. So during those 5 days, it was at least the first 3 days, it was very much a matter of rehearse and contribute and attempt things and not be afraid to fail, to make a fool of yourself. Just pick yourself up, and if it didn't happen this time, then the next time you experiment, maybe it will. It was a wonderfully supportive creative environment. And Dick Van Dyke was the most generous and supportive human being that I have ever worked with, and he very strongly influenced my life and my standards when I went out on my own later on.
Oh, I have another question about Laura Petrie's look.
Yeah.
Laura wore a flip. Perfect little flip.
Yes.
Whose idea was the flip? And how were you wearing your hair in real life at the time?
In real life, I was wearing it in a flip, but it wasn't quite as backcombed and lacquered as it was on the show. I mean, that thing had so much hairspray on it, you could hang clothes from it.
When you say that thing, was it your hair or was it a wig?
Yeah, it was my hair, but it was quite thoroughly sprayed and done by somebody else. But my in person, in between shows, that was the way I wore it. It was just a little limper.
Well, let's talk about the Mary Tyler Moore Show, a show which I still love to watch. I'm so glad that Nick at Night carries the shows. I still love to watch the Dick Van Dyke Show and Mary Tyler Moore. Now, the Mary Tyler Moore Show got started because CBS wanted to build a series around you.
Mm-hmm.
And you and Grant Tinker hired people to, you know, come up with the idea, write a series. What was the original premise?
The original premise was not too different from the one that we ended up pursuing, but I was to be divorced from a doctor. And rather than having, as we ended up doing, having me live with this doctor through medical school and internship and residency and then been dumped, CBS felt that having been divorced was unacceptable from a societal point of view, that people would see nothing humorous in divorce. How could you possibly laugh at a woman who had a broken marriage in her past? And not only that, but my God, they would think you were divorced from Dick Van Dyke, the world's most wonderful, adorable person.
That's so silly.
Yeah. And instead, what's so odd from a morality point of view is that they found it acceptable that I had lived with this doctor, never married him, and then the relationship broke up and I went off to start my new life. So I don't know. Morality, I guess, is a very personal thing.
Mary Tyler Moore. She's written a new memoir called After All. We'll talk more in the second half of our show about the Mary Tyler Moore Show and about how her life changed when that series ended. This is Fresh Air. This is a national fundraising week for public radio. Think about how many years great TV sitcoms like The Dick Van Dyke Show and The Mary Tyler Moore Show have endured. And think about how long public radio has been with us. NPR is celebrating its 25th anniversary this year. This anniversary year has been a financially difficult one, as you know. The next chapter in the public radio story will be written by you and by listeners like you as you decide whether to make a pledge or to let this opportunity pass you by. Please call with that pledge and help write the story of our future. Many public radio stations are fundraising this week and are using this time for a pledge break. Those of you hearing our show uninterrupted will hear a new special series this week from our rock historian Ed Ward on the American cities that gave us rock and roll. We begin with Los Angeles. By the time the Beach Boys came along to sing hymns to Southern California and its glories, Los Angeles had been a rock and roll city for almost 20 years.
I know that most people think rock and roll started when Elvis Presley walked into the Memphis Recording Service, but the fact is that he was propelled there by a love for black music he'd picked up from records recorded and manufactured in Los Angeles. L.A. was a natural place for the birth of a new popular music in the post-war era. Blacks and hillbillies by the drove arrived there for war work, and the blacks discovered that the jobs weren't segregated and paid everyone equally. Thus, they had money, and they spent some of it on entertainment. Central Avenue became one long strip of nightclubs and restaurants, and its customers demanded modern jazz and sophisticated blues. They got it.
I dreamed of heaven, saw my baby there. I dreamed of heaven, saw my baby there. She had pearly white teeth and coal black wavy hair. Hoy, hoy, hop. Hoy.
Roy Milton and his Solid Senders were only one of a myriad of bands playing for dancers on Central. There were Jimmy and Joe Liggins, Roy Brown, Wynonie Harris, Lucky Millinder, Earl Bostick, and a million others who faded into obscurity. One of the most successful was Johnny Otis, a Greek-American who'd opened the Barrel House, a club in Watts that was criticized for being too far away from the black community, but Otis knew people were moving out there. He also played the vibes and was a noted talent scout for record companies.
Been looking for you, Daddy. I just found you in time. You hit some other woman and you swore that you were mine. What's the matter, Daddy? Don't my kisses satisfy? If I don't thrill you, baby, goodness knows what I've tried. Folks say that.
Among his discoveries was little Esther Phillips, who was barely 14 when she recorded Double Crossing Blues. Competing with this sophistication was more bare-bones music. B.B. King started recording in L.A. early in his career, and then there was the vocal group sound.
Darling dear, love you all the time. I'm just a fool in love with you.
Wow.
thanks to DJs like Art LeBeau, this music penetrated the Hispanic parts of town, too, and was much a part of the Mexican-American as African-American sound of the 50s and influenced people like Ritchie Valens. The Southern Whites had their scene, too, and while L.A. never usurped Nashville's title as home of country music, Western swing performers like Hank Thompson, Spade Cooley, and Bob Wills, not to mention Hollywood singing cowboys like Roy Rogers and Gene Autry, contributed to the mix. And when white kids in L.A., people like Eddie Cochran, started doing rock and roll, they came out of this scene, or, like Ricky Nelson, used its musicians. I'm a gonna raise a fuss, I'm a gonna raise a holler. About a working all summer just to try to earn a dollar. Yeah, every time I call my baby, try to get a date, my boss says,
no dice, son, you gotta work late.
Sometimes I wonder what I'm gonna do, but there ain't no cure for the summertime blues. There was work in the film industry, too, and at one point, the entire New Orleans A-team of studio musicians pulled up stakes and moved to Los Angeles. The 60s started with a uniquely Los Angelian sound.
Let's go surfing now, everybody's learning how. Come on a safari with me.
Surf music could have come from nowhere else, and along with establishing another piece of the California myth, it established the primacy of the electric guitar before the British invasion turned it into the essential rock and roll instrument. The Beach Boys, though, were unique, thanks to Brian Wilson's obsession with sound, an obsession that was inspired and shared by Phil Spector, who used LA studios and studio musicians like no one else had ever done before. The orthodoxy of the hippies, though, held that L.A. was plastic, and few of the counterculture bands that arose there were considered hip. Exceptions were the Byrds, of course, the Doors, and Love, a band that didn't sell too well when they existed, but exerted an influence well past their sales figures. The 70s saw the decline of Los Angeles as a center of creativity. It wasn't until roots-oriented L.A. punkers like X and the Blasters rediscovered the Central Avenue scene that L.A.'s place in early rock and roll history was secure.
Ed Ward is a writer living in Berlin. His series on the American cities that gave us rock music continues tomorrow with a look at New Orleans. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Mary Tyler Moore about her role as Mary Richards on The Mary Tyler Moore Show and the trajectory of her own life. When her second marriage broke up, she was alone and single for the first time.
Thank you.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second half of our interview with Mary Tyler Moore. She's written her autobiography. The Dick Van Dyke Show and the Mary Tyler Moore Show are still going strong on Nick at Night, and now Moore is co-starring on the new CBS series, New York News. In the first part of our show, we talked about breaking into show business and co-starring in the Dick Van Dyke Show. We begin the second part with a look back on the Mary Tyler Moore Show and the characters that Mary Richards worked with in the newsroom. The character of Ted Baxter was originally conceived as being someone of your age.
Right.
And there might be some, like, romantic attraction between you?
Exactly. He was probably going to be tall, dark, and handsome, and instead what walked through the door was Ted Knight. Short, white-haired, and handsome, yes, but not what you'd call a love interest. But the writers, the writer-producers, Jim and Alan, were so open. And I think that's an important part of being a successful artist is being open to new ideas and input. And they saw this man and they began to think potential. All right, so it isn't our original idea, but oh, wow, look and feel and salivate over all the juicy stories we could do in another direction. And that's what happened. And they cast Ted.
What won them over? Was that big pretentious voice part of it?
You know, there was another thing that won them over. It wasn't just the fact that he was pomposity to the nth degree, but that there was a vulnerability and a sweetness to Ted. We found out later that Ted, who was a more out of work than in work actor, had gone out and bought himself a blue blazer and a crest and had it sewn on the pocket so that he would look the part. And everybody just thought that was, real throat-clenching stuff. And, you know, if there had been any doubt about whether or not he was the right one, that clinched it.
You write in your book that later into the series, Ted Knight wept because people thought he was really stupid.
Yeah.
They confused him so much with the character.
Yes, I don't remember exactly what year it was. I think it might have been the second year. I think it was the first year. And he was so successful. I mean, he was a unique character. No one had ever seen anybody like him as a continuing role in a series. And people were mistaking him for the character he played, which is so often true for those of us in television. And they would, and of course, both the first name was the same, Ted. And they were calling him stupid and, oh, you're the funniest dumbbell we ever met, and boy, are you dumb and stupid, and somebody called him a dumb schmuck, and he came into Jim Brooks and Alan Burns's office. Actually, it was only Alan in the office this day, and he was unable to speak. He was just sobbing, and apparently it had just spilled over at that particular moment. He said, I can't go on. I can't do this. I am a dignified man. I have standards, and I am proud, and I'm well-read, and everybody thinks I'm stupid. And so Alan pulled out all the stops and reminded him of all the great clowns in history who were cerebral and admired and who did great works in life by not only the good works themselves, but by making fools of themselves, by pratfalling, by doing all the dumb things that make people think you're dumb. And he was pretty much convinced and on his way out of the door when Jim Brooks came in and said, ah, Ted, the world's favorite schmuck.
Oops.
But he had a sense of humor about it, and he got it out of his system. I think that's all he needed to do. I think, you know, that's probably all a lot of us need to do on many occasions of frustration is just say it, get it out, and sort of let the steam out, you know, let the top of the kettle off for a minute.
I think one of the real famous moments in television openings, you know, one of the famous freeze frames is you throwing your hat in the air mm-hmm. in the opening of the show with the
right.
jingle underneath.
Yeah.
Do you remember that moment?
Oh, do I? It was freezing cold. It was in Minneapolis in January, I think, or February. And we didn't know what we were doing. We were just there to grab a lot of footage that shows a young woman's exuberance, being in a new city, looking around, gazing at the sights. And I had in my hand a hat, a little beret that my aunt had given me for Christmas, and I had packed that along with whatever other warm things that I had, which weren't too many because I was a Californian, to go to Minneapolis to do these film spots. And Jim Brooks said, "Oh, I have a good idea, Baring. Take that hat, put it on your head, and now run into the intersection, and it'll be all right. We'll watch for cars." And throw it up in the air as if to say, "This is my town, and I'm celebrating my life that is taking place." And I did it, and luckily, magically, wasn't hit by a car, although I got some pretty strange looks. And in fact, I guess it must be in every episode, you can see this one woman in the background who looks at me as if not only am I the world's strangest person, but that she would like to personally lock me up. But it's interesting, isn't it, that something that becomes burned in people's impressions and memories can happen so happenstancely out of nowhere. It wasn't written. It was just a spur-of-the-moment idea.
So that traffic was the real thing.
Oh, yeah, it was. And it's a good thing I didn't have to speak any lines because my lips weren't working. It was so cold. I literally could not form words.
Huh. Mary Tyler Moore is my guest. She's written a new autobiography called After All. I have a colleague here who said, "The Mary Tyler Moore Show made me who I am today, single." And I thought that was particularly funny because, you know, all those years you were playing Mary Tyler Moore, you had no idea what it was like to be single. You got married as soon as you got out of high school. You divorced, but you were only single for about 6 months before marrying Grant Tinker.
That's right. Boy, you've read the book, haven't you?
Yes. Yes. So really, you'd never lived that kind of single life.
No, I hadn't. And when Grant and I finally ended our marriage and I went to New York to do a Broadway play, Whose Life Is It Anyway?, I decided to stay in New York and try to capture my life for myself. I had never been on my own. I had never experienced any of the situations that Mary Richards had lived for the rest of the world every week. And I set about to make that happen for myself. I dated, I made friends, I had a little apartment, I did my own shopping and schlepped my own clothes to the dry cleaner and back and the laundry and all of that stuff. And I sort of generally played house. But in real life.
I'm interested in hearing a little bit about your own family when you were growing up, since after all, you know, you portrayed one of the most famous couples on television on The Dick Van Dyke Show, and then had a wonderful family of friends and colleagues.
Yes.
On The Mary Tyler Moore Show. When you were growing up, your own family was probably what we'd now call dysfunctional.
Yeah, yeah, I suppose so. It's an overused phrase, and I wish we could be a little more specific about it.
I agree.
I didn't mean to criticize you for that.
I didn't take it that way.
My mother and father were very much the couple that Grant Tinker and I became. They say that you do follow the patterns that you grow up in, and this was certainly true in my case. WASP, repressed, unable to deal with things that are uncomfortable, pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps, not discussing anything that's ugly or unpleasant, and just muddling through. A little of Beth Jarrett in Ordinary People came from those people, from myself. And I emulated that with Grant Tinker. My father is a very well-educated intellectual, a lover of classical music and classical literature. My mother was an English major, and everything was just perfect in that house, but nobody was talking to anybody.
Well, another thing that was less than perfect is your mother drank.
My mother was an alcoholic, as I was to become. Her alcoholism took another form from mine. She would, by the dint of determination, be sober for months at a time and then be unable to continue. And all of the problems that had been building up and she had been stuffing under the rug of her emotions would burst forth, and she would start drinking in the day, and she would not stop until somebody found the bottle and took it away and pretty much held her captive. in the house until she sobered up, and we were able to plead with her to stop, and then she would try again. Back then, nobody knew what we know about alcoholism today, and the kind of counseling it takes, and the kind of sharing and support that is needed to get through this, to break this cycle. They feel now, I think most scientists agree, that there is a genetic predisposition to alcohol, which in combination with other factors in life is going to almost guarantee some form of dependency in later life. My form of alcoholism was much more controlled because I grew up in that very uncomfortable, very sad situation, and I determined that I was never going to do that, never be drunk. And I probably never was really out and out drunk. And I certainly never drank during the daytime. But I wasted a lot of my time, and I forgot a lot because I didn't remember much of what had happened the night before. I got out of proportion angry about things that were really unimportant, but that's what alcohol does to you.
My guest is Mary Tyler Moore. She's written her autobiography. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mary Tyler Moore. Did being an actress help you be able to drink and not show the signs of it? Help you cover it up?
Maybe so. I don't think so, though, because once your speech is slurred, once you lose balance, there's no way you can pretend that away. But I paced myself. I never allowed myself to drink any more than the company I was with. And that way nobody could judge me, nobody could see.
Did you drink alone?
Yeah, I did, but I was seldom alone, except when I moved to New York. And then I was alone, and then my drinking really escalated. Mm-hmm. And I found myself not going out after 5 o'clock and making sure that everything was set up for me to have my dinner there on the bed that was by the air conditioner, that was near the phone, that was near the television set, and that I had my blender full of drinks that I was concocting in an attempt to do something worthwhile in the kitchen. and it was a pretty sad lady that was emerging.
Were you afraid that the press would find out that you drank a lot, and it would
no,
be this whole thing?
No, because I didn't think I drank a lot.
Oh, I
that's
see.
The amazing part of it. Uh-huh. Most alcoholics are in such a state of denial about their condition. They will blame everything but themselves for whatever is going on. I didn't have hangovers per se, but I found that it was getting very difficult to hold the eyeliner brush steady when I was applying my makeup in the morning. So I thought, I guess that's just something that happens when you enter your 40s, and it's a nerve-wracking city, so I'll just have to, take a little more time with it or use a thinner brush, whatever. And I had nobody to point out to me the lack of sense that I was making and the deterioration of my thinking.
You stopped drinking, I think it was, the mid-80s?
It was 11 years ago, yeah, I guess. That was the mid-80s, yes. 86?
You did Betty Ford.
Right.
Do you think your emotional character changed after you stopped drinking?
Oh, there's no question about it. in a way, I sometimes feel grateful that I did have this alcoholism, except that there were so many sad events that were caused by it that I can't wholeheartedly say that. But at least it got me to the Betty Ford Center, where I was able to, with the help of some counselors and a lot of group therapy sessions, examine myself and the way I handled my life and the way I handled problems and the way I reacted to any given situation, and was able to make major changes. I allowed myself to be imperfect. I allowed myself to make mistakes and laugh at it, to handle my real-life mistakes the way I handled the acting mistakes on the Dick Van Dyke Show, to think of those as positive steps forward rather than anything to be ashamed of.
One of the movies that you've made over the years is Change of Habit, which is an Elvis film in which he plays a doctor in the ghetto.
And he plays a singing surgeon. And I play a nun.
A plainclothes nun.
A plainclothes nun who's out of the habit. And it was a story about these two dedicated social workers who come together in the ghetto to bring about goodness to all mankind.
But you start to fall in love, and at the end you must choose between God and Elvis.
Right, and you see a shot of me in church looking from the Jesus, the statue of Jesus, and Elvis playing guitar, and then to Jesus and Elvis and Jesus and Elvis and Jesus and Elvis, and you never know at the end who I finally chose. I was Elvis's last leading lady. And he apparently said in somebody's book, he is quoted in somebody's book as having said, there's only one leading lady that I didn't sleep with. And guess what? I know who she is.
Right. So what was it like to play opposite him?
It was wonderful, and he was nothing like the image that that a lot of us have about him back then. Gosh, what was the year? I don't know, maybe 67 or 68, something like that. He was in great shape, and he was working out, and he was watching his diet, and he was living a good life. I mean, yes, there were a lot of ladies in and out of his trailer, but he was sweet and wholesome, and he knew his dialogue, and he had done his homework, and he was—he had a big crush on me from the Dick Van Dyke Show, but you know, in a reserved, from a distance kind of way. If he didn't watch himself, he'd call me ma'am, and he was very shy and kind of awkward with me.
Now, this was hardly the film that either you or Elvis became best known for.
Right. I think it's better said that we triumphed over. In spite of this film, we continued.
Now, did you regret making the film as it was being made? Did you have a sense that this was not going?
Oh, no. I didn't know what I was doing at that time. Movies were new to me, and, you know, they may have not felt as well written and directed as the television shows that I had been involved in, but I thought, well, see, that's the difference in the medium. You know, this is a movie, and so they know what they're doing. And as it turned out, they didn't. But it's all right. Now, I really don't regret anything that I've done in terms of my work. If I were writing a happily ever after piece, looking back, sure, there are things that would probably be better if they were erased and maybe not included at all. But I think I've learned from everything I've done, and I can't help but bring those experiences to what I do today.
Mary Tyler Moore, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it, Terry. It's like talking with a pal.
Mary Tyler Moore has written a new autobiography called After All. You can see her on Nick at Night as Laura Petrie and Mary Richards, and you can see her on CBS in her new series, New York News. This is Fresh Air. When someone like Mary Tyler Moore writes an autobiography, I think of it as a fresh air opportunity. It means she's ready to talk about what really happened behind the scenes in the making of now classic pop culture. What really happened is, I guess, what I always want to find out. Let me tell you what's really happening now on public radio. This is a national fundraising week. As you know, it's been a difficult year financially for public radio, so this is an especially important week. Please call with a pledge. We can't afford to take public radio for granted. Mary Martin was one of the great Broadway stars, but between her debut in 1938 and her breakthrough into superstardom in Rodgers and Hammerstein's South Pacific in 1949, not much is remembered about her. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says a new disc of her early recordings, Mary Martin, The Decca Years, helps fill that gap.
While tearing off a game of golf, I may make a play for the caddy, but when I do, I don't follow through, 'cause my heart belongs to daddy. If I invite a boy some night to dine on my fine Finnan Haddie, I just adore his asking for more, but my heart belongs to daddy. Yes, my heart.
It's hard to think of the Mary Martin we know and love from South Pacific, Peter Pan, and The Sound of Music as sexy, but that's certainly how Broadway first saw her. In her first show, Cole Porter's Leave It to Me, she sang the song that she made famous and that made her famous, My Heart Belongs to Daddy, sitting on a trunk in a Siberian railroad station wearing nothing but a short fur jacket. Her next major Broadway part was the title role in Kurt Weill's One Touch of Venus. In the meantime, she went to Hollywood, but what made her light up Broadway didn't conform to Hollywood's idea of glamour. In the movie version of One Touch of Venus, Ava Gardner was cast as Venus, and most of the songs were cut. None of Martin's films are very satisfying. Still, she did great things in them, like this effervescent, marvelously harmonized version of Wait Till the Sun Shines, Nellie. It's from The Birth of the Blues, which she made with one of her favorite movie partners, Bing Crosby.
Wait till the sun shines, Nellie, when the clouds go drifting by.
We will be so happy, Nellie.
Don't let me hear you make a sigh.
Don't let me hear you make a sigh.
Way down in Lover's Lane we'll wander,
sweetheart, you and I.
We'll be so happy together, but it all depends on the weather, man.
Nellie.
Oh, Nellie.
Once now.
Don't you sit there and sigh. If you will wait till the sun shines, Nellie.
In the sweet.
In the sweet.
In the sweet.
Just be discreet
and wait till the sweet by and by.
At the heart of this album are six Cole Porter songs that Martin recorded in 1940. It's especially interesting to hear what she does with numbers Porter originally wrote for Ethel Merman, Martin's only real rival as queen of musical comedy, and virtually her opposite. Martin's trained voice had a cool, soigné sophistication, very different from Merman's forthrightness, yet quite compelling in its own way.
I get no kick from champagne. Mere alcohol doesn't thrill me at all. So tell me, why should it be true that I get a kick out of you?
Of course, Decca, Martin's record label, wanted to cash in on what was still her sex pot image. She does a wonderfully pouty cover of the Cole Porter song that contains what may be his most blatant double entendres, Let's Do It, a version that's also a breathtaking example of blasé World War II-era racism. The sexiest number on the album, though, is not by Porter, but by George Gershwin, with lyrics by Buddy De Silva, Do It Again. It's a great song I especially associate with Judy Garland, but it's also one of Martin's best performances. The little squeak in her voice reminds me of Hollywood's most captivating girl next door, Jean Arthur. I love the way Martin suggests that the repeat performance she's begging for may have already begun.
Oh, do it again. I may say no, 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 but do it again.
my lips just ache to have you take the kiss that's waiting for you. You know if you do, you won't regret it. Come and get it on. No one is near. I may cry, oh, oh, but no one will hear. Mama may scold me, 'cause she told me it is naughty, but then, oh, do it again. Please do it again. Oh.
Besides Porter and Gershwin, Martin also sings some relatively unknown songs by Irving Berlin, Frank Lesser, Julie Stein, and Raymond Scott. I've been taking a perhaps perverse pleasure in Martin's enunciation of a Johnny Mercer line that's one of the oddest lines ever written for a popular song. The waltzes and mazurkas, we hate 'em, we spurn 'em. As for its context, I'll leave it to you to discover for yourself.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Mary Martin, the Decca Years, 1938 to 46, on the Koch label. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller, technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Old Amsterdam, do it, not to mention the thin. Folks in Siam, do it, think of Sammy's twin. Some Argentines without me, do it. People say in Boston even bees do it. Oh, let's do it. Let's fall in love. Romantic sponges, they say, do it. Oysters down in Oyster Bay, do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love. Cold Cape Cod clams against their wish, do it. Even lazy jellyfish, do it. Let's do it. Let's fall in love. Electric eels, I might add, do it. Though it shocks them, I know. Why ask if Shad, do it? Wait to bring me Shad Row in shallow shoals. English souls, do it. Goldfish in the privacy of bowls, do it. Let's do it all. Let's fall in love.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.